But this is what that was hidden. So this Don Abedian personally signed 3 volumes, and we've now gone through 15 years of this. So this book was published posthumously after Don Abedian died. He wrote this for the Armenian community, and that was the intention. And it's a very simple introduction to quality. Again, sort of like the way Steffi writes, every word, every sentence really is just packed with ideas and meaning. It's very short, and we, in order to preserve these messages from Don Abedian, I photoshopped them in, and I'll just read the first one. For wherever I may be, I salute your dedication to advancing quality in healthcare, Avitus Don Abedian. So these are his handwritten tributes to our winner.
Thank you. It's a real honor, and it's an honor to hear such praise from Gordy, who has dedicated a great deal of his own professional career to quality improvement and is a very original and wonderful thinker in the area. I got interested in the issue of pay for performance, some because I am a clinician and it's just so darn annoying, you know. But also because I started seeing some of the information in the behavioral economics literature and began working with Daniel Ariely, who's got a couple best-selling books on behavioral economics. So a lot of the thinking and structure of this reflect things I've learned from Dan Ariely, things I've learned from Gordy, and things I've learned in my own experience about pay-for-performance. Is pay-for-performance toxic to quality improvement? I think clearly the answer is yes, but before going there, I don't have any disclosures. And here's my Don Abedian quote. Systems awareness and systems design are important, but not enough. The ethical dimension is essential to the system's success. Ultimately, the secret of quality is love. The problem with pay for performance is really by dangling money in front of people, you can undermine the love, the moral commitment to our patients and to improving healthcare for all, that is at the core of efforts to improve quality. But let's start with a little evidence. There are several randomized controlled trials relevant to the issue of pay for performance. This was a randomized controlled trial of paying residents to order fewer tests. These were unnecessary tests. So paying them actually a large chunk of money if they would reduce their test ordering. And lo and behold, the financial incentive actually increased the test ordering, made it go the wrong way. And in contradistinction, an educational intervention, just talking to the residents and teaching them that it was in the patient's interest to reduce ordering, worked much better and reduced testing. So this is an older study, but RCT, and pretty relevant to where we are today. The other two major RCTs were done in the teaching profession, which obviously has a lot of similarity to the medical profession in terms of public service, professionalism, long-term goals, if you will. And this experiment was run by Roland Fryer, who's now actually won a MacArthur Genius Award. But in 200 high-needs New York City schools employing nearly 20,000 teachers, they were offered incentives of up to $3,000 per teacher if they got the kids' test scores up, along with graduation and attendance rates. Turns out that it had a negative effect, that in fact test scores, if anything, went down in the schools that were randomized to receive the monetary reward. Okay, and we can talk about why this is, but my short version is the teachers were trying really hard in the first place, and offering them money was not going to change things. But the study was actually more or less repeated in Nashville schools with 296 middle school math teachers who were offered up to $15,000 per teacher per year, giant pay for performance award based on test scores, and overall there was absolutely no effect on test scores. Okay, these are done randomized but actually very good observational studies. This is the Medicare Premier demonstration project where they're going to pay for performance to 253 hospitals And actually, initially, people may have seen an article in New England Journal supporting the idea that initially there were some small benefits from pay-for-performance. But at the end of 5 years, actually the pay-for-performance hospitals performed less well than the control hospitals, looking at mortality reduction, so lower, going further down is good in this slide. Mortality reduction was actually greater in the control hospitals. So a giant experiment, millions, tens of millions of dollars of Medicare money, negative effects, or at least zero effect of pay-for-performance. Finally, in a similar vein, there was a large pay-for-performance experiment in British hospitals, and the pay-for-performance hospitals are in blue, the control hospitals are in orange. And at that point, there's a ways into it where the two lines converge. It looks like maybe the pay-for-performance hospitals are doing better. Again, there were reports in the medical literature. Pay-for-performance works in Britain. But over the long term, you'll see that the lines stayed apart, and there was absolutely no effect in the long term of this very expensive pay-for-performance scheme in Britain. Most expensive pay-for-performance scheme in family doctors, again, it's in Britain. There were multiple quality parameters that the doctors had to meet, initially 146, I think it's up a little bit at this point, and they're recorded in a new EMR, so you check the box that you met your quality parameter, and they're summed into a point system. And it was fabulously successful the first year. The GPs made like 97% of all the points out of 100, and it generated a much welcome 25% increase in PCP's income. So initially it would look like a success. However, when people went back to study it, they found that the scheme accelerated improvements in quality for two of three chronic conditions in the short term. However, once the targets were reached, the improvement slowed, and the quality of care actually declined for two conditions that had not been linked to the incentives. So what you pay for got better, but things, until people meet the targets, and then people stop improving, what you don't pay for actually gets worse because of the distraction. But what about the things that got better? One really significant thing that got better is the doctors got essentially 100% of the points for controlling blood pressure. Many of us would think, well, that must be a wonderful thing. They got the points, they recorded, they got the blood pressure down and checked the box. Someone went back and actually looked at the blood pressure of these people, measured the blood pressure in the community of the patients of these doctors. And there was absolutely no improvement in the blood pressure distribution in the population where these doctors were practicing. So in the office, they met the target. In the community, if anything, it looks like there might be a slight worsening of blood pressure control. And similarly, when you looked at hypertension outcomes like heart disease or stroke, there was absolutely no improvement associated with pay for performance. So I want to you to keep this in mind as I show you two recent studies, which again give information about doctors in offices reporting that blood pressure is controlled. One of these was this big experiment using almost the same methods as in Britain, where they put a new computer system into primary care doctors' offices in New York, and they reported big improvements in these physician-reported measures. Okay, no outcome measures, but physician-reported measures. And similarly, there was a study released on the VA, which appeared or does show that on physician-reported measures, you get improvement by offering individual incentives to doctors. But I think given the British experience, we have to be a little bit skeptical about whether these meaningful targets were really met. These are how you can game a blood pressure control scheme, and I did not make these up. In fact, a large medical group practice in Boston has been circulating guidelines to their doctors telling them to do these exact same things. Okay, the first thing is you keep checking blood pressure throughout the year, right? You know, and say in September, you get under 140, you hit the target there at 138, let's say. Do not schedule them to come back until next January, because you've hit the target, and bringing them back before January can just worsen your target. So being told to do this, okay. You can change your digit preference from 140 to 139. Anyone who's ever taken a blood pressure knows you can use, There's no difference between 140 and 139. And they were actually instructing medical assistants to record 139 preferentially over 140. Okay, you get your credit for treating people if you give them lifestyle advice. So someone comes in, their blood pressure's too high, you just write down, I told them to eat less salt, and you've met your goal without really working with them to make them do that. Most serious is the issue of firing patients who can't or won't comply. So patients who you cannot meet the targets, figure out some way to get them out of your practice. And unfortunately, that's happening all over the country as well. Okay. Not surprisingly, Cochrane Review has found that there's no evidence that financial incentives can improve any meaningful patient outcome. Whatever you can do with the numbers, there's no evidence in a Cochrane Review of improved outcomes. Now, why this negative result? I mean, don't we all respond to rewards? Isn't that human nature? Turns out that may not be true in situations like healthcare or education. All right, and I want to go through the assumptions implicit in pay for performance. I think actually Gordy gave me this list, but maybe he just gave me some of this list. But the first assumption is that performance can be accurately measured in the face of financial incentives to cheat. Okay, so I think we can measure performance. We're striving toward that. We're trying to get data. But if you give people financial incentives to cheat, you corrupt the data, and you may not be able to measure things at all. And I'm going to give you some evidence on that. Second assumption is that the current payment system is too simple. We ought to make it more complex. The third is that variation in performance is caused by variation in motivation. The fourth is that financial incentives will add to our own intrinsic motivation, our own desire to do good work, rather than undermine it. And I'm going to spend quite a bit of time on that and go through some of the behavioral economics literature. And that hospitals and physicians currently delivering poor quality care should get fewer resources. Okay, first assumption, that performance can be accurately measured, particularly in the face of financial incentives to gain the system. Well, it turns out doctors who take care of poor patients get lower quality scores. And this particular study looked at doctors in a Harvard system, and you'll just have to take my word for it as someone who's worked there for years. The doctors who do take care of the poor in the Harvard system are very well trained. They're very well credentialed. They're not different in any fundamental way, as far as I know, from the doctors who take care of rich people. I know that may not be true every setting, but it is true in this particular group of which I was a part. It turned out, despite the doctors being equal in terms of credentials and skill, the doctors who scored at the top on the pay for performance saw fewer minorities. They saw fewer non-English speaking patients, fewer uninsured patients, and fewer patients who made infrequent visits. So if you're taking care of a difficult population, even a very good doctor, you're going to get a low quality score. So it's very difficult to measure how good the doctor is in this setting. Someone did a simulation of how much money you would lose by taking care of poor patients, and in the pay-for-performance scheme that was being implemented in Massachusetts at the time, you'd lose $3,000 to $7,000 a year by focusing on minority or poor patients based on the inability to achieve the quality targets. But it's not just primary care. If you look at surgery, surgical mortality, right, really important issue, surgical mortality is consistently higher if you take care of poor patients. Right? And I really don't think the doctors are trying to do a bad job on poor people. Yeah, there may be some scoundrels out there. I just think it's a more difficult situation when people's underlying social situation, health situation may be worse. Okay. Finally, cheating. What about cheating on the data? This is actually about HEDIS data on, is one of the HEDIS measures, is a prescribing measure for the elderly, certain drugs you're not supposed to prescribe for the elderly. And this particular measure is one of the very few self-reported measures under the HEDIS program that there's an external check on it. The external check is actually Medicare Part D billings. Okay, so these are HMOs looking at their HEDIS scores, and Trivedi and his colleagues decided, oh, we're going to do an external check and look at their Medicare Part D billings. It turned out that 95% of all the Medicare HMOs were cheating on this measure. 95%. And by big numbers, you know, big percentage numbers. And the 5% of plans that failed to cheat had the bottom score. They looked like they had horrible quality because everyone else was cheating. So I doubt that this is an anomaly. I actually quite sure through my own experience, through the rumors you hear, what you hear in the doctor's lounge, but also through this one study we were really able to check, that you just induce a tremendous amount of cheating by putting pay-for-performance into the mix. I don't know if many of you are familiar with the Press-Ganey surveys, but the patients are surveyed and they rank their doctors and the hospitals on a scale of 1 to 5. And hospitals are now being reimbursed in part based on these Press-Ganey scores. But you can get consulting firms to come in and tell you how to get your scores up. And this is the type of campaign, the I Strive for 5 campaign. Okay, because it turns out you have to get a 5. If you get a 5, you've gotten 100% and you look really good. If you get the level below a 4, you're actually in the bottom 1%. And you're gonna lose money. Okay, so they go around and hand out these cards. This is actually a card that someone got after a 2D FAQ. Thank you for choosing Advocate Healthcare Trinity for your 2D Echo. It was a pleasure to meet you. Thank you. And then the name of the Echo Tech and I Strive for 5. So just nudging you to give me a 5. Don't just say it was good and give me a 4. You must give me a 5. It's obviously a tremendous waste of money. It's got nothing to do with improving the quality of care, but a way that the data becomes corrupted, that you can't even tell what the patients really think in this setting. Finally, a much more challenging issue, and one I'm not going to go into very much, but door-to-balloon times, okay, when people have a heart attack, you want to get them in for treatment and open up those arteries as fast as you can so you can save the heart muscle. And a door-to-balloon time, the time from arriving at the hospital to opening up the artery has been seen as an important quality measure, and it kind of makes a lot of sense that this would be an important quality measure. But when it was turned into a quality measure, this is what happened. Door-to-balloon time fell, but there was no change in mortality. So we have to be very skeptical. Even things that seem like they make a whole lot of sense, we need proof that improving them is actually going to improve quality. Okay. Similarly, hospitals scoring high on the so-called leapfrog quality measures, very well thought out measures, do not have lower mortality. So again, the link between these process measures of mortality, very tenuous. In fact, and this was actually a very compelling study, sometimes better hospitals end up with worse scores because one of the quality measures for hospital care is did the patients get a blood clot in their leg, a VTE. But you only know about the blood clot in the leg if you do a very good job in diagnosing them. And so hospitals with higher scores on structural quality measures actually diagnosed more blood clots in the legs and looked worse on that measure. So a lot of complexity here, and the last thing we need in the quality movement is to start putting money on the table. Okay, we need to be figuring out what the really important data is and get people to cooperate in honestly collecting their data. Unfortunately, even mortality rates can be quite deceptive. It seems like how can you gain mortality rates? It turns out that if you look at the 4 leading metrics for measuring mortality, basically risk-adjusting mortality among hospitals, you get wildly divergent views of which hospitals have high mortality and which have low mortality. A hospital that will look excellent under one metric will look downright dangerous under another. So not an easy task. Okay, the Achilles heel of risk adjustment is a problem of upcoding and overdiagnosis. And I'm going to spend a lot of time on this because it's the Achilles heel, not only of quality determination or pay for performance, but also in the whole concept that we're going to be able to use ACOs, sort of like warmed over HMOs, in order to reform healthcare. It turns out that because the ACOs and HMOs are paid based on a risk adjusted capitation. Okay. It turns out that by maximizing the number of coded diagnoses and comorbidities, doctors, hospitals, and HMOs can make their outcomes look better, and in circumstances where payment is risk-adjusted, make a lot more money. You know, do they do this? Absolutely. This is what happened when the DRGs came in. All of a sudden, everybody had four or five diagnoses. Okay. People didn't get sicker overnight. They were just able to earn more pay by adding more diagnoses. This is a modern story. The one hospital had an emergency. They had just heard their Medicare adjusted mortality was 1.42, 42% above expected. Their response was to spend $500,000 in coding consultants. And the results is the next quarter their adjusted mortality was normal again, and the next quarter it was below Medicare standards. And by the way, reimbursement rose by $3 million. Okay. Now, what did the coding consultants do? They sent nurses onto the wards to, you know, tap the doctors on the shoulder and get them to change the wording in the chart. So if you said acute kidney insufficiency, that does not bump the risk score. But if you say acute renal failure, it does. If you say magnesium equals 1.6, even though that's very specific and informative, doesn't bump the risk score. You have to say hypomagnesemia. So just by getting people to change from one synonym to another synonym, they boosted the risk score, made the quality look artifactually changed, and increased the payment. Okay. But so upcoding, you're probably familiar with that, but I want to talk a little bit about the twin sister of upcoding, if you will, the non-identical twin sister, which is overdiagnosis, just attaching diagnoses which the patient may have but which don't necessarily do them any good. People may be familiar with the Dartmouth data that in many parts of the country, like my own home state of Louisiana, where we are right now, right, some parts of the country, like Louisiana, spend almost 50% more than other parts of the country, like, say, Minnesota. And I just personally don't think it's plausible that the quality of care is better in Louisiana than Minnesota. I did train here, but I'm going to get more back to that in a minute. But turns out that these places that spend a lot more record a lot more serious diagnoses for patients. Okay, that's how they spend more in Medicare. They could record more serious diagnoses. But some researchers looked at people who moved from a high-cost area to a low-cost area, so someone moving from Minnesota to Louisiana, or someone going the other direction, right? And it turned out that if you move from a low-cost area to a high-cost area, you acquire diagnoses much quicker than if you stayed home, okay? So just the fact of moving to Louisiana or South Florida made you look a whole lot sicker on paper. Is it possible that these people really were sicker? I mean, it's obviously a hypothesis, but if so, they should have had a higher death rate, overall death rate. Now, it turns out the death rates are actually pretty much identical across spending regions or across regions by number of diagnoses. So some places, people get a lot of serious diagnoses added to their chart, probably more investigation. I guess you can do PSA screening and say they have prostate cancer. You know, you can do lung cancer screening. You add a lot of diagnoses, but they're not necessarily sicker. And Gordon Welsh concluded that if diagnosis is not solely an attribute of the underlying disease burden, adjustments based on frequency, meaning the number of diagnoses, may introduce bias into efforts to compare outcomes and to control costs, but for today's talk, to compare outcomes. Okay. So Medicare made an attempt to improve the risk adjustment under the Medicare HMO formula. It was made in 2004. And before 2004, Medicare just did their risk adjustment based on age, sex, a couple of other things. If you're in an end-stage renal disease program, if you're dual eligible. But they found there was a tremendous amount of cherry picking, that HMOs were looking for healthier patients so they could make more money. So the risk adjustment formula in 2004 added initially 70, now 90 diagnostic categories to try to risk adjust. And this is what happened. At baseline, what I'm showing is the overpayment to the Medicare overpayment to HMOs. Part of it, the blue part, is congressionally mandated. Congress has decided to overpay HMOs. But the yellow part was the cherry picking that was going on before the risk adjustment. And they expected that by adding the 70 diagnosis risk adjustment, that the cherry picking would shrink. Okay, according to NBER paper, the amount of cherry picking actually increased. I'm showing it here using the figures that Jason Brown concluded with, which is $3,000 per person in continued cherry picking. Joe Newhouse, who actually is a very good economist, but unfortunately has a severe conflict of interest as a board member at Aetna, claimed it's only about $1,100. But there's no dispute in the policy world that the cherry picking is continuing despite all these this so-called adjustment. Now, how could you end up beating the adjustment? I'm just going to give one example. There's other ways to do it. But one really effective way is to over-diagnose heart failure. And for those of you who don't know, almost everyone over the age of 80 has what doctors call a stiff ventricle. Okay, and if you look, you can say they have a stiff ventricle and call them heart failure. They don't have any symptoms. You're not doing them any good, really. There's no reason to do anything if they don't have symptoms of it. But a heart failure diagnosis would increase the HMO's capitation by 41%. It's more than $4,000. So, but among patients who've gotten this diagnosis, the costliest of them, the ones who are really symptomatic, average Medicare spending of almost $40,000 a year. The guys are in the hospital once a month, right? The least costly 5% average $115 a year. Obviously, these are the people with a stiff ventricle with no symptoms. Okay? If you just do universal echocardiographic screening, you could label essentially all people over the age of 80 as having heart failure. And there's some, that's just one example, a clinical example of how you could really make your quality scores look good, because your heart failure patients would do very well and also get paid more. And that's the kind of thing that Jason Brown and these other people have been documenting. Okay. Consequently, despite the extremely high overhead administrative costs of Medicare HMOs, they've really continued to soar, been able to make a lot of money and to expand and continue to drain a lot of money from the traditional Medicare program through their overpayment. This is relevant to the new move to ACOs, and ACOs are not identical with HMOs, but are very, very similar in that they're based on paying a risk-adjusted capitation amount based on the patients enrolled and letting the institution keep any money that's not spent on patient care, so capitated systems. The difference is ACOs are more likely to involve the providers along with an insurance company rather than just an insurance company. However, this ACO advertisement is sponsored by Aetna, so it is actually an insurance construction as well. I just want to make two points. The ability of commercial HMOs and ACOs to improve morbidity or mortality or to save costs system-wise is completely unproven. So we can think of systems that do a good job, but by and large the Veterans Administration, I'd say, would be one of those. But the ability to take that concept and commercialize it and save money, no proof that that ever has worked anywhere. And there's reason for skepticism because the ACO movement is driving massive consolidation of hospitals into giant conglomerates and physicians to leave small-scale practice and go into salaried practice under the hospital auspices. And in the past, consolidation of providers has invariably raised rather than lowered cost. So I'm tremendously skeptical of this proposal. Here's the evidence on cost. When hospitals own practices, the costs rise. This just came out in JAMA a couple of months ago, but obviously much higher costs when the hospitals own the practices. Similarly, just looking at the size of physician practices, the more consolidated physician practices are into one giant group, the higher the costs are. Again, data just came out last month. Okay, Don Abedian himself thought HMOs were a good idea, but only if the financial pressures could be removed. So this is not about integrated systems in a public service-oriented mode. It's about integrated systems in the midst of a healthcare system that's profit-oriented and based on financial incentives. Okay, second assumption about pay for performance, that the current system is too simple and more detailed contracts rewarding specific aspects of performance will improve quality. This is part of a larger debate in the economics community about so-called contract theory, but the basic premises of contract theory is there's two types of contracts. Okay? There's the incomplete contract, which is like a handshake deal. you know, you do something and I'll pay you. It lays out only the general parameters of an exchange, like staff that you're going to spend 30 minutes with the patient. But it leaves the myriad details and unexpected contingencies to be covered by social and professional norms. Okay, so it pays me for my time and assumes I'm going to use social and professional norms to determine what I do in that time. And it counts on my own intrinsic motivation, my desire to do a good job, to help drive adherence to those norms, and to maintain the goodwill necessary to resolve disputes should they arise. That's an incomplete contract, a handshake deal. This was developed in Oliver Hart. This is the book where he sort of first proposed his contract theory. Okay. In contrast, a complete contract would be an ironclad agreement that specifies all the parameters of an exchange, every detail, and if something is omitted, there's no default to goodwill. It's happy hunting season. You know, you told me to check the blood pressure, you didn't tell me to weigh the patient, I'm not doing it, okay? Complete contracts have very high transaction costs, and because you have to enforce all these rules. And according to Hart and other contract theories, that's why firms exist. That's why we just don't go out on some, you know, neoclassical world and have every just contract for every service individually. Anything you need in a business, you let it out and hire somebody to do it, right? We don't do that. We create firms because we cannot have complete contracts within, that's why firms exist. In any event. The problem with trying to make our contracts more complete by specifying, let's say, 146 quality improvement measures has to do with the really very high transaction costs in a system which already has extremely high transaction costs and lots of administrative work. Okay. The other assumption implicit in pay-for-performance is that individual variation is called by variation in motivation, that poor performance is a matter of intention, and that change in motivation is therefore likely to improve performance. If poor performance is not willed, then incentives can't change it. And, you know, I make mistakes. They burn in my memory, the bad mistakes, but I never willed myself to make a mistake on a patient. And I just think many of you think about the mistakes you made. You never, it was not that you weren't motivated. There might be something else. You might have been too tired or whatever. But and I think that's the issue with teachers, to be honest. There may be a lot of problems with teachers. There may be problems with doctors. But they're not willfully doing a bad job. And that's, okay, assumption four, financial incentives will add to intrinsic motivation and not undermine it. And here, I don't have to tell you anecdotes. You know, here there's a lot of good behavioral economics data, behavioral science experiments, that if you start paying people for something they already passionately care about, you can make matters worse. There's two types of motivation. This is just lingo, many of you may know it. There's extrinsic motivation, like you're going to get paid or you're going to get punished, you're going to get rich. Intrinsic motivation, like pride, joy, it feels good to be a good doctor, it feels better to be a better doctor. I want to keep it clear that reward versus recognition. Reward, giving you money, that's extrinsic motivation, but recognition and celebration is actually a different thing, like my Bonabedian Award. That's got me more motivated, not less so. Okay. So the short version of it is...
So we're paying Steffi a lot of money.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know, the short version is, will you help me move a sofa? You know, if I asked Gordy to help me move a sofa, he'd probably say yes. And this is actually a very funny picture because they're moving the sofa on the New York City subway. You know, versus, you know, will you help me move a sofa if I'll pay you $3? And you're almost certain to say no. You know, so there's two economies. There's a social economy based on doing the right thing, and there's a economy based on getting paid. And you tinker with that at your, you know, great risk. But this is actually Dan Ariely's study. It's a summary of a very long and expensive study they did. They offered these MIT students either a very small amount of money, $10 to come in and solve math problems, or $300 to solve math problems. Big bucks, right? They scored better for $10 than $300, okay? Because solving complex math problems requires focus, it requires creativity, and you can interfere with that by dangling too much money in people's faces. In fact, for simple manual tasks, the more they got paid, the better. But for anything that can require complex cognitive work, creativity, people perform worse with very high stakes. They actually repeated this in India, where they were able to offer people rewards of 6 months cash income and saw the exact same effect, that two higher rewards will actually interfere with creativity and cognitive processes. This actually just came out last month, too, in the National Academy of Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and looked at West Point cadets. And those who had very high intrinsic motivation, and that's the yellow bar at the top, yellow line is very high intrinsic motivation. And if they had, and intrinsic motivations were things like, I want to be an officer, I believe in the military. And if adding to that extrinsic motivation, like I want to get a good job, I want to be paid a lot, added to or reduced their long-term performance, 10-year follow-up. It turns out for people who were either at the median or higher in terms of their intrinsic desire to do a good job, extrinsic motivators actually reduced their performance. For people who had essentially no intrinsic motivation, yeah, money increased their performance. But for the majority of people who start with high intrinsic motivation, desire to do a good job, dangling extrinsic motivators was associated with worse long-term outcomes in terms of staying in the military, being promoted, et cetera. So I don't usually think about military analogies, but very interesting long-term follow-up illustrating the crowd-out effect of extrinsic motivators on your own intrinsic motivation. Randomized controlled trial of people giving blood donations among frequent donors. If you send them a letter, say, please donate, you can have $50. You'll actually reduce the response relative to just a letter asking them to donate. For people who are not frequent donators, you don't really get any effect. But giving money to people who donate blood because they think it's the right thing to do actually reduces donations. If that was actually designed to be a randomized controlled trial, testing Titmus's famous hypothesis from the gift relationship, for those of you who are interested in welfare theory. Okay. Another rather famous experiment in Israeli daycare centers, they randomized daycare centers to have fines versus no fines for picking up your kiddies late. And when fines were imposed, you actually saw an increase in late pickups because you had transformed picking up your kid on time from a moral obligation into a market transaction, right? And when the fines were removed, it didn't work. You'd already poisoned the well, and people continued to pick up their kids late. Okay, so this is actually the results of a meta-analysis of 120 studies on motivational crowd out, on extrinsic rewards crowding out intrinsic motivation. Tangible rewards, particularly money, undermine motivation for tasks that are intrinsically interesting or rewarding. Symbolic recognition, such as praise or flowers, don't crowd out intrinsic motivation, and they may even augment it. Further, the negative effect of rewards appears stronger for more complex tasks. I think I showed you some data for that. Crowding out effects tend to reduce reciprocity and augment selfish behaviors. They make people selfish in other ways, okay? The crowding out effect may spread both to other tasks and to coworkers, and crowding out is strongest when external rewards are large, perceived as controlling, contingent on very specific task performance, or associated with surveillance, deadlines, or threats, okay? So many of these factors that would tend to maximize the money crowding out your intrinsic motivation are there in medical pay for performance. Okay. Finally, the last assumption implicit in pay for performance is that the hospitals and physicians currently delivering poor quality care should get fewer resources. And you put that together with the information I gave you about very good doctors, equivalent doctors scoring much lower if they took care of poor people, and you get a result like this. I'm not sure if there's anyone from Los Angeles in the audience. Yeah, okay. This was King Drew Hospital in Los Angeles, which had quality problems. I assume some of them were real. But the hospital was closed, okay? The only problem with that is it left an area of South Central LA with 1.5 million people and no hospital, okay? Three times the size of the state of Vermont in terms of population and no hospital. And in order to get from the site of King Drew to the hospital to get care was an over an hour on a bus. So we have to think very carefully before we start closing hospitals, closing down practices, particularly those that serve poor people, whether we're better off actually trying to improve and give more resources to hospitals with quality problems rather than punishing them by taking resources away. Okay, that's it, and I look forward to hearing what Gordy has to say here.
If we'd only paid Steffi a little bit more, we could have had a good talk. Steph, I think let's do a little Q&A, especially, you know, some specific questions. There's so much, I think, that your talk has stimulated. Again, what I have to say is sort of...
We don't know what yours is going to stimulate, right. But we can try. Okay. Yes, sir.
Thank you for that really good talk. I was wondering if in your review of the literature,
People don't look at health status disparities in that context. I'm not aware of anyone looking at health status disparities. There are people who have argued looking at like process measures that if everybody's performance improves, you do get some narrowing in the process measures. Others haven't found that. So, but there is some literature saying by pulling everybody up, you can actually get some narrowing of disparities. It may be a little bit of threshold effect because many hospitals will hit close to 100% on some of these process measures. So if you're pulling everybody up, you've almost inevitably got to narrow the gaps. Yeah, outcome measures, I'm not aware of literature. I don't know if you are, Gordy. I haven't seen anything on it.
But I think there is some emerging literature that shows that poorer hospitals, poorer clinics are getting further behind in terms of getting reimbursed here. So, that last assumption that Steffi critiqued, there's actually emerging data to support that. And it's worrying people. Even the people who believe in this stuff, they can't quite figure out how to get around that.
Yeah, good point, yeah.